very pleased to be joined at this time by Ned Colletti. Ned, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on the book launch. A book launch at Foley's, I've got to think that went pretty well. Ned, are you there? There you are. Ned, are you there?
Yes, sir.
I gather the book launch at Foley's went pretty well.
Well, you've been to Foley's, so you know with or without a book, it went pretty well. It was a great spot, great time, good people. Sean's the best, so it was a great opening act.
Well, congratulations. Congratulations on the book. I'm always interested when people sit down to write a book, a memoir, general managers, managers. When did you decide to do it, Ned? Like, when is the right time for a person who's still in the game to sit down and write a memoir? Because I always used to remember joking with Felipe Alou and saying that, you know, Felipe, I'd love to write your book sometime. And he said, well, first of all, I wrote a book in 1964, which in fact he did. But then he also said to me, Jeff, my book's going to be written after I'm dead. So there you go. When's the right time to sit down and write a book?
Well, I was going to find it very difficult to write it if I was dead. So I decided I was going to start it maybe a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't start it to really write a book or to publish it. I started it just to get a million things off my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I've had this blessed career for 35 years, and how I grew up. I grew up living in a garage in Chicago, then little house after that. And I wanted to get it down because I spent most of it traveling around, running around, worrying about other people's kids in a way while my own kids were growing up. So it was kind of a letter to my children at the beginning, and then little by little I started to spend more. When my GM gig changed, I started to have all this free time. And mm-hmm. So I just kind of wrote it to write it, to get like a personal piece sort of thing done. And I was at dinner about a year ago, and I ran into an old writing buddy in L.A., and he says, hey, I want you to meet my literary agent here. And he sits down. I sit down with this literary agent, David Vigliano, and David says, have you ever thought about writing a book? I said, well, I've been writing. I got like about 400 pages done. And he goes, 400 pages? Show it to me. I said, well, I don't even know if I want to sell it. And he goes, let me see it. So I sent him a couple chapters. He said, send me the rest. I sent him the rest. He says, I think you got something here, because it's not a revenge book. It's not a kiss and tell book. It's just a book about my life, growing up, how I grew up, kind of motivational here for probably young people that wonder if they can ever aspire for greatness and get there. And also what's it like to sit in the chair,
mm-hmm.
you know, the x-ray of the job. You got so many people play fantasy sports now. They're the GM, but that GM is different than the Blue Jays GM or the Leafs GM. It's obviously far different. So I wanted to give people a look inside. As I wrote deeper and deeper, I wanted to give people a look inside of free agencies and into trades, into ownership, into managing a staff, managing a team. So that's what I did.
You know, I went through a timeline, just the timeline of when you were with the Dodgers and you know, the people that you've talked about, you know, managing a team, managing people, the people you were involved with, not just the players. Ned, what did you learn about yourself over the course of your career as both, an assistant general manager and a general manager? What did you learn about yourself when you started? You know, you're managing people with big egos. You're managing people with big money. And you're managing people, you're managing people who are in some ways living a dream, but also getting paid to live that dream. What did you learn about your own abilities as a manager?
There was probably a few things. That's a great question. I probably answered 1,000 questions the last couple of weeks. That may be one of the best. I'd say that there's a few things that stick with me. What I learned about myself was that at the end of the day, there's only a few things in life I'm going to be able to control or impact in a positive way. And when the organization went through a really tough time with the owners getting divorced and then a bankruptcy that ensued, every day I was asked, well, what about the bankruptcy? What about the divorce? Is this going to hurt the team? Does this affect the roster? Does this affect the payroll? And it may have, it may not have, but it didn't make any difference if it did or it didn't, because whatever it was, I had to figure out how to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it kind of allowed me to focus in on figure out parts of life that you can affect in a positive way. And the rest of the stuff, and I know we all get slammed with rumor, innuendo, issues at home, issues in the professional workplace, all these different things. And I had to learn to really kind of focus in on things I could really affect, not 80% of the things that I would be asked about, but really the fine line of what you can do. Same thing with Joe Torre, same thing with Don Mattingly. We had to fix the team. We had to make the team as good as possible. That's all we could really try to do, no matter the other circumstances. So that was a big lesson. Something else that I kind of knew, but I learned more distinctly, is in a way my professional reputation or Mark's professional reputation or Lou Lamoriello's professional reputation is really based on how other people perform. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of left you're kind of beholden to the guys in the Leafs uniform or the Jays uniform or the Dodgers uniform, because if they play really well, people are going to say, hey, great going. You know, if they don't play well, it's like, what were you thinking? And so it doesn't necessarily fall on the athletes as much as it falls on the manager or the GM. And so you're kind of responsible for a lot of things that you're responsible for putting people in your organization. But once they start performing, you are secondarily responsible for how they perform. And that can be frustrating from time to time.
You know, I was looking and just throwing out names. And again, this is just your career with the Dodgers. So it doesn't you're with the Giants as well when Barry Bonds is there. But I'm just throwing out names. Grady Little, Nomar, Jeff Kent, Greg Maddux, Manny Ramirez, David Wells, Joe Torre. These are, and Yasiel Puig, of course, you were involved in that. Grady Little, these are all people who are kind of big, big parts of baseball history in different, you know, in different ways, and on various different levels. How do you manage big personalities, Ned? You know, how do you manage people who can kind of suck the oxygen out of a room when they just walk into it?
Well, you know that getting into it, that you're going to have almost a degree in psychology and sociology. And I learned a long time ago, you can't, and I use the illustration of a painter. When you deal with people, you cannot spray paint the entire room. You need a fine brush because everybody's different. And I had to figure out, you know, how to get the best out of Jeff Kent, who I knew from San Francisco, I had him in both cities, was a gamer. Guy would play. But is he going to be Mr. Personality? No. You got to figure out how to really have conversations with a guy like Jeff. Same thing with Barry. Same thing really with all of the players. I knew Maddux since he was 18. I saw Maddux throw his first pitch. I saw him throw his last pitch. Only guy to ever trade for him. I traded for him twice. But I had known him for so long that the relationship I established with him when he was still a teenager at 18, 19 years old, originally drafted out of Vegas, a Las Vegas high school, that thread of getting to know him at that age carried all the way through for 25 years. And so he and I always knew, I kind of knew what he was thinking. If he looked at me with an eye, you know, I knew what was coming next. He knew when he looked at me, he knew what was coming next. And you just have to do that. Manny Ramirez was somebody that was so interesting. Him and Barry, I think, are two of the most interesting people I've ever been around, in that they are genius at what they do talent-wise on a baseball field. Mm-hmm. But have to really manage the personalities and their ebb and flow of their life. You're on it. You're on it with them. And, you know, if you want to be, you can jump on that train, and you know, for a half hour, an hour, you're going to be on the ebb and flow of their life, too. And a lot of athletes or performers that are at the upper echelon have a different type of personality. They don't have what you would consider, you know, just run-of-the-mill or everyday personality. And so I always had to learn, to answer your question, I had to learn each individual and figure out how my communication would best match up with their ability to receive communication and back and forth. And everybody's human. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got the human trait. You know, no matter what the salary is, it could be $30 million a year, it could be $1 a year. everybody's human. Everybody's got issues. Everybody's got concerns. Everybody's got goals, aspirations. And like any manager of anybody, even at, you know, at a small office downtown Toronto, you have to know the personality of who you're talking to. And I just had to always keep that in mind, knowing that, you know, some of them are going to make $25 million, some of them aren't, and all of them are going to affect the public perception of who I am, you know, going back to the other point.
I got it. I'm going to read this, page 341 of the book. I love this. I spent 11 seasons with the Giants and Barry Bonds. My relationship with Barry was pretty much the same as many others in the first year or so. I said hello to him my first spring training in Scottsdale in 1995. I said hello about five more times that season. Not once did he acknowledge me. During spring training 1996, I was walking through the clubhouse and Barry called out to me. I was surprised. Quote, "Hey, Ned, how come you never say hello?" "Barry, I said hello to you a half dozen times last year and you never once acknowledged me." "That's okay. I don't need you to talk to me. All I want is for you to play as hard as you can to give the team your best, and you've always done that." And you say, "That was the beginning of a very decent friendship." And I love this paragraph. "Barry never tested positive for steroids. He tested positive for being non-responsive to the media. He tested positive for not being a teammate who would lead the group hug. He tested positive for being unapproachable. He appeared arrogant, aloof, nasty, difficult. But if you earned his trust and never violated it, he was loyal and kind. If you violated that trust, you would never be allowed anywhere near him." When you look back on your time with the Giants and with Barry Bonds, what is, you know, leaving aside steroids, if you possibly can, what's the biggest takeaway for you about Barry Bonds? And, you know, Ned, do you ever figure, and I'm throwing you in this group, I'm in that group, people around the game, is there any guilt that maybe we weren't a little more aggressive when it comes to going after steroids in their initial phases?
Wow, that's a lot of questions, right?
Yeah,
there. I don't think people understood what was going on for a long time, no matter who it was. And I think by the time it started to become a quiet question, and then maybe grew into a whispered question amongst people, it was probably pretty far down the road at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never saw anybody do anything. And all I know is what I read about who tested positive via the Mitchell report or other reports that have come out since or suspensions that have occurred. But you know, I don't believe it was confined to superstars.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the 26th man trying to be the 25th man, trying to make a roster. I think it was the 13th pitcher trying to be on a 12-man staff. I think it was a lot of different people that felt that they needed to compete on an even basis. And I think as you listen to players in the last 5 or 6 years, you know, they don't want to do that anymore. They don't want to perhaps jeopardize their career or their life by trying to compete with somebody who is. So the players have kind of become the watchdog for the players as well, I think. Barry, going back to him for a second, I found him to be a genius as a hitter. He would not know every pitcher's name, but he knew the arm slot. He knew what they could throw. He knew what likely was going to happen. And I've only seen a few guys like that. Barry, genius. Manny, same thing. Maddox on the mound, same thing. Thought like nobody else thought. Probably like I knew Gretzky a little bit years ago, how he would see the game of hockey. They see the game of hitting or the game of pitching. It was phenomenal. Michael Jordan, how he saw the game of basketball, Magic Johnson. They see it in snapshot form. We see it as a movie. They go in and they see it. They play it at full speed, but they see it in snapshot form. A couple other things about Barry. I would see him set up a pitcher and look foolish on a breaking ball or a changeup early in the game, thinking in the seventh inning he'd get the same pitch and he'd hit it in the water in San Francisco, or really play it and wait for August or September to come around when it was an interdivisional game, and he knew the pitcher thought he could get him out the same way, and he'd set him up, and he'd hit it out. And after the game, I go by his locker and go, "Hey, B, you know, that guy threw you the same pitch, you know, 4 months ago, and you looked a little foolish on it." He just give me that smile and a wink and walk on by.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the personality part of him, after that first year, he figured out that, you know, I didn't need anything from him except what Brian Sabian needed, which was for him to play hard. That was all. And he became such a decent guy with us. And I got to the point where if I had to walk by his locker, I needed to have a half hour in my back pocket because he could stop you. And next thing you know, you were talking baseball or life for a long time. But he also, I think, was conflicted sometimes. I think he had a lot of people in his life that disappointed him, that he had brought into his circle, and they disappointed him as time went on and maybe took advantage of him. And so I think he was conflicted whether or not to push everybody away and only kind of pull back a few that he could really, really trust to deal with him in an honest, genuine way versus being a, quote, nice guy and letting everybody into the circle and then finding out that people had taken advantage of him along the way. I saw all different sides to Barry. And at the end, where I come out on is if he trusted you, you were in, and you'd be in for life.
In conversation with Ned Coletti and the Jeff Blair Show, what's it like to give out a contract to a human being, a $200 million contract or a $100 million contract? Ned, are you ever kind of aware, and I'm not saying this as a pejorative, but as a general manager, you ever sort of look at the contract and go, my God, I mean, $100 million, $60 million. Did you ever do that?
Oh, did I? You know, in the book, I talk about, you know, where I grew up. I grew up in a Chicago garage. My dad turned into a house. We moved into a house that wasn't even 900 square feet. So the value of financial wherewithal is always part of my DNA. And I would look at the negotiations, and I would actually do what you just said. I would stop myself in the middle of one of them. I go, I can't believe I'm talking about this number. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about somebody who makes $18 million a year. They're going to make $100,000 a day during a baseball season. My dad worked himself literally to death. He made $17,000 a year. This person's going to make $100,000 today. And it is mind-boggling. But, you know, then I would go back and it would be the market because there were like six other players that were just like the player I was trying to sign. They were making a little bit more and a few making a little bit less, and my guy sat right in the middle, so I had to get a deal done. But when you stop back and you think about it, it is unbelievable. It really is. It's striking to me. It never became nonchalant to me or, oh, who cares? You know, this is what it is, $100 million, this is $100 million. Don Zimmer used to, you know, when contracts started to get gain and value and this and that, and I've known Zim for, I don't know, 30-some years, and I run into him, and he goes, hey, so-and-so just signed for $15 million a year. And I look, I go, can you believe it? He goes, I guess it's not a lot if you say it fast. But, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, think of those guys, what they saw, you know? I mean, Zim probably made $30,000 as a player, $20,000 as a player. No, he's managing guys that are, you know, in his managerial time, probably making $5, $6, $7 million a year. But it is a phenom, and it's something that is so interesting. And the other side of that too are the players. Not every player comes from affluence. Some players, as you know, some of the kids from Latin America, they slept on dirt. They ate rice and beans most every day of their life if they had a meal. And now suddenly there's $100 million in their bank account. It's almost like it's two different people, two different lives. It's almost like they probably read about the little kid. And it is such a dramatic change in the way the game is not only played, but the process of the thoughts to get to a successful place. Years ago,
go ahead.
Years ago, parents would ask me, "My daughter or son wants to work in professional sports. What should they do academically? Where should they go to college?" Well, in the States, you had University of Massachusetts in Amherst. You had Ohio University. Those were two of the bigger first schools that had sports management degrees. Now, many schools have that degree. I would tell them, go to that school. The last 10 years, whenever I'm asked, I said, if they love sports, they're going to get a ton of sports just in their everyday life. I'd make sure they had a degree in sociology, a major in psychology, a minor in sociology, and be able to speak two, if not three, languages. That's the difference. The psychology of the sport now, I found myself thinking about it daily. If I was thinking about the game 12 hours a day, 10 were on the psychology of how do I get this player, big name, little name, How do I get them as good as they can be, regardless of what the paycheck says?
Ned, before you let you run, and I really could spend an hour talking to you about this, but before we let you run, do want to ask you about the Dodgers. They're kind of sitting there biding their time, waiting for the winner of the Nationals and Cubs. That series will be decided. That series will be decided tonight. A lot of us, I thought the Diamondbacks were going to be a real handful for the Dodgers. You know, the Dodgers kind of did what they had to do. Do you feel comfortable about where the Dodgers are right now?
I do. I really do. And I think the sometimes, and we've all been, yourself, myself, we've all been around so many baseball seasons, and you see the ebb and flow and the tenor of a team and the tenor of a season. They've been planning, they've been methodically putting this type of month together, using their pitching staff judiciously, not overextending a lot of guys, having a lot of different guys come and go during the course of the season to save people's arms, to save people's mental, you know, like the emotional drain that a year will go through. That they went through Arizona as quick as they did surprised me a little bit, because I thought AZ was going to give them a battle offensively. They hardly did. Mm-hmm. Little here, little there, a lot of home runs, hardly any rallies. Now they sit and they wait. And you got Kershaw, who's still feeling probably some effects of being on a DL for a while, has not pitched quite as exceptional as he did prior to going on the DL. You have a chance to rest and to get this thing really lined up again the way you want it to do it, while Washington and the Cubs continue to play hard against each other day after day. Extra day, yesterday was a day late, so no off day going into this. Whoever wins tonight will have played Wednesday, would have flown east Thursday night to play, ends up playing Thursday night, and then will fly cross-country, get to L.A. sometime Friday and play Saturday, where the Dodgers have been sitting here most of the week. Now, you can get a little bit slow because you haven't been playing, but this group is destined there. They are so fine-tuned to the thought process from day one. Dave Roberts has done a tremendous job with the culture and getting these guys to play together. I've been around a lot of these guys a long time, drafted a handful of them, traded for a few of them, signed a few as free agents. I know who they are, and I know how they think, and I see them thinking in the best possible way they've ever thought since they've been in this uniform. And I credit the front office and Dave Roberts with really defining this culture. I think they're in a great spot. I think they're in the greatest spot they've been in, probably maybe even before 1988, which is their last World Series, because that team had Hershiser and Kirk Gibson and was really banged up by the time they got to October. This team is not banged up. They hurt like everybody else hurts, but they are almost full go when you consider how most teams are compromised at this point in the season. I think it's laid out. They still got to play. They still got to execute. They still got to make pitches. Every pitch in a postseason can change the history of a city, of a franchise, of a team, of a player. But they are sitting in a spot right now that they haven't been in for decades, and I think they are fiercely waiting for the challenge.